In the first two programmes of this series of Earthrise, I've been looking at how the law is being used to force governments and multinational corporations to take climate action. But what about the changes already going on within the business world itself? In this programme, I'm exploring whether transforming the economic legacy of the Industrial Revolution could, in part, be an inside job. I'm beginning my journey in the UK, in the historic university town of Oxford, where I'm meeting self-styled renegade economist Kate Raworth.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
I want to hear why she thinks it's critical that business changes.
They call this era the Anthropocene. It's the era in which humanity, we have become the biggest driver of change at the scale of the Earth system. Post-World War II, economies began to grow, particularly because of the availability of very cheap fossil fuels. But with growth, we have consumption, we use resources, we burn fossil fuels, and it's taken us into extreme crisis, the climate and ecological breakdown. And there is no evidence that it's possible to have an endlessly growing economy and to come back within planetary boundaries at the speed and scale that's required. We actually have to shift from pursuing endless growth to thriving, which brings us into balance. Everything that thrives in life on this planet grows until it's grown up, and then it stops trying to grow, it matures, and it thrives and can thrive for a very long time, and so can our societies if they mature, instead of trying to grow endlessly and inducing a collapse.
So this is a huge transformation.
Yes, it's not an incremental tweak. We must go from degenerative systems to regenerating the living world. We need new policies that may have never been tried before. We definitely need new business models and designs. But it's easy to say, it's a completely different matter to actually remake this in practice.
So how could production systems be updated for the realities of the 21st century? First off, I'm looking at the manufacture of a material which is a symbol of the industrial era and a bedrock of the modern world.
I've gone to the city of Luleå in the north of Sweden, where plans are afoot to decarbonise one of the world's most heavily polluting industries.
SSAB is Sweden's largest sheet steel manufacturer.
It's an extraordinary-looking building.
Monica Quintero is site manager and my guide.
We feed the blast furnace with iron ore pellets and also coke. At the bottom of the blast furnace, we get melted iron. And out through the chimney, we get carbon dioxide.
How many tons of carbon dioxide are produced as a result?
We make 2 million tons of steel every year and 3 million tons of carbon dioxide.
Oh, well, that's really got to be changed, hasn't it?
We are longing to transform into a process that doesn't produce carbon dioxide.
You can really feel the heat. There is so much power and energy here. It feels like looking at a technology from an olden age. Of course, it's not. This steel factory is very much alive and kicking now. But this is a production process that has to go.
Steel production is responsible for around 7% of global CO2 emissions. But a solution for this has been discovered, and it's on the other side of the site. This is the Hybritworks, a research and development facility for green steel. Opened in 2020, it's a collaboration between SSAB, energy supplier Vattenfall, and the Swedish State Steel Company.
Hi, Martin.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
You
welcome.
Too. Thank you so much.
Chief Technology Officer Martin Pay is leading SSAB's charge to become the first company to bring what's known as fossil-free steel to market.
Here in northern part of Sweden, we have completely fossil-free electricity because of the access to hydropower and also wind power is increasing.
Green electricity is used to split water into oxygen, which is released into the air, and hydrogen, which is captured to use for energy.
Essentially, we use green hydrogen to replace coal that we use today in the blast furnaces. And with that, we get rid of the CO2 emission from steelmaking.
Completely?
Completely, yes. This is a big step for the whole industry when we make this transition.
SSAB plans to move quickly, with the first commercial hybrid facility up and running by 2026. Developing new green technologies is costly to start with, but failing to do so comes with a huge business risk. Research has shown that if emissions aren't stopped, climate breakdown could cost the global economy $23 trillion by the middle of the century.
Climate disasters create a lot of cost for the society, and that cost is not allocated to partner steel yet. But if you take into account that cost, then the new way to make steel will not be too expensive.
This is a huge project shrouded in secrecy, but I can see the end product.
So this balls is actually pure iron.
So I'm holding a world first.
Yes, this is the first time that we have succeeded with a trial in at this scale.
So you seem really excited holding this.
Oh yes, this is really beautiful for me. Yes.
And this pioneering product is already in demand.
This truck here might look like many others, but in fact, it's the world's first ever vehicle made with green steel.
Lars Stenkist is the chief technology officer of Volvo Group.
We have learned that we can use the same process in our manufacturing for fossil-free steel, and that means that for us it will be rather easy then to increase the share of vehicles that are being produced with fossil-free steel in the coming years.
Volvo Group started working on this vehicle just 1 year ago, part of its pledge to reach net zero by 2040.
We have so many customers committing to decarbonize. It's clear that the demand is turning into green products. And if you don't move, then you will just be out of business.
It's one thing to build a specialist vehicle from fossil-free steel, but how do you decarbonize the entire transportation sector? In Gothenburg, Volvo Cars is committed to having an all-electric fleet by 2030 and being carbon neutral by 2040. EVs are hailed as the zero-emission transport solution, with global sales almost doubling in 2021. But eliminating exhaust gases is only one part of the story.
The car product itself is the problem. 33% of all CO2 emissions of the product is coming from the steel, then aluminium, and then you have the battery pack itself with all the battery materials. So steel, aluminium, and all battery materials together account for 75% of the CO2 of the product.
And the other 25%, where's that from?
It's plastic, it's all kind of like smaller materials, glass. I mean, you have CO2, unfortunately, in basically all elements. It's a tremendous work.
Even if charged using only renewable energy, the amount of CO2 emitted over the lifetime of this EV is 27 tonnes. Volvo Cars has joined Steel Zero, a global initiative pledging to use 50% green steel by 2030 and 100% by 2050. But the rest of the supply chain has to follow suit. Easier said than done when there are so many elements involved.
I could stand and watch this for hours. It's like a feeding frenzy down there. But it is really making me ponder everything that goes into one car. All the energy, all the technology, all the materials. Imagine if it was all green.
Volvo Cars is seeing this as a clear and, well, business critical risk to us.
Jonas Otterheim is Volvo Cars' head of climate action.
We see that the whole world needs to change, and we need to change with it. We know that unless we change, the consumers won't want to buy Volvo Cars from us, or the lawmakers don't allow us to sell these future cars. So this is one of the biggest business risks we have long term.
Do you actually think it's possible to meet climate targets?
I'm feeling confident in ours, but I think it's important to recognize that the world is not yet set up to deliver on what is needed. So I'm a bit mixed there to say that every company in the world also takes the steps that we want to do but still see as challenging. I think that is likely too hard to believe in right now.
The companies I visited seem genuinely committed to change. They've seen the writing on the wall. But transforming the business sector globally is an immense task. Just one third of the world's largest public companies have set net zero targets. Less than half of these meet even minimal reporting standards. I've come to the Swedish capital, Stockholm, to meet a climate solutions expert who's convinced we should be looking towards the future rather than trying to rectify the past.
We're trying to live and create tomorrow with yesterday's tools. We can't compromise. We need to reduce emissions. We need to reduce the outtake of resources for the planet in order to survive. There's a number of things that really threaten our civilization as we know it. And that's an existential threat. And we've not really had that before.
Decarbonizing the supply chains then isn't enough.
No, we can't have the resource intensive, not very smart society that we have today. And we can't just tweak it. We need to fundamentally rethink that. We need to go back and ask, what do we need? Because we have today the transport sector, but we don't need transport. We need access. But for access, we don't need cars. We can have that through 3D printers, drones, virtual meetings. So the digital economy is just providing fundamentally new ways to provide for things.
And this emerging digital economy is enabling startups to leapfrog established technologies, disrupting the old industrial order. I've come to visit one of them in the south of the UK.
Hi, Greg.
Amanda, great to meet you.
You too.
Octopus CEO Greg Jackson is an entrepreneur with a flair for tech and a mission to shake up the energy sector. In just 6 years, Octopus has gained over 3.5 million customers in 14 countries. It's valued at over $5 billion.
In this building, the energy comes from the grid, but it also comes from solar panels on the roof. And this box, at any moment in time, is deciding what to do with it. Store it in the car, use it to power the home. If it's going on the grid, wait till the grid price is higher. That way, the homeowner gets the maximum financial benefit, but they don't need to think about it.
You're doing that through digitizing energy.
This is all digital. Just in the UK, Octopus Energy gathers 1.5 billion pieces of data every day to do this optimization.
These bites of data may be tiny, but with energy in the form of electricity, heat and transport contributing nearly three quarters of all emissions, their potential impact is huge.
Our mission is to make the transition to renewable energy faster and cheaper than anyone ever imagined. And that's not only great news for advanced economies, but also the 800 million people who don't have access to energy today.
The costs of wind and solar are decreasing all the time. But at over $9,000 a piece on average, there's one key item for warming homes that is still beyond the reach of most people, the heat pump. This centre is devoted to making them available to all, and in the process, permanently switching off gas.
A heat pump extracts heat from the air. It takes that heat, pumps it into the building. Heat pumps turn one unit of electricity into three units of heat, whereas for every unit of gas you burn, you get less than one unit of heat.
And how are you actually going to get the cost down?
Just through standard economies of scale. We need to increase the heat pump industry to the scale of the gas industry. And when we do that, the cost will plummet.
The International Energy Agency says heat pumps are the key technology in the world's transition to sustainable heating. Greg is readying an army of installers to speed that transition up. 1,000 are being trained here each year.
For every 1,000 engineers we train, we can install tens of thousands of heat pumps a year. This is the beginning of a revolution that's going to sooner or later be available to everyone that currently has a gas boiler.
Greg's vision is already starting to come alive. Octopus has teamed up with Ilke Homes, which pre-build zero-carbon houses, a more sustainable technique than constructing them on-site.
There's going to be over 100 zero-carbon homes generating electricity on the solar panels on the roof, a battery to store it, and a heat pump to keep the home warm with no bills.
Wow.
And homeowners will be able to sell surplus energy back to Octopus. So they benefit, and no energy is wasted.
This house generates more electricity than it uses. And so the energy world of tomorrow is one in which energy is decentralized, it's distributed. The ability to start building homes like this helps us reduce the reliance on the national grid. And it enables innovators to bring solutions to communities and to individuals faster than we imagined. It's inevitable. The world is either going to go clean on energy or we're going to end up with such catastrophic climate change, we lose the option.
I come to a project like this and I have this real sense of impatience because the green transition is underway. The old system needs to move over to make way for this new sustainable, well, I was going to say future, but it's not a future. This is actually happening now.
But is the world ready for the wider consequences of this change? Its impact on everything from people's jobs to states' revenues? According to systems change analyst James R. Beebe, it's impossible to imagine what the future could bring.
What we see coming is a fundamentally different system that we've never seen in human civilization, where the inputs into that system are all available locally in abundance. It's a totally different system to the old system. You know, there's nothing about a caterpillar that tells you it's going to be a butterfly. And that holds for when we think about the kind of transformation we're going to see in the economy.
Can you give me an example?
We're seeing solar be rolled out extremely quickly, and it's going to transform industry after industry. So any demand that's capable of shifting will respond to that incentive of zero-cost power. So we could do things like make hydrogen, we could do vertical farming, we could do steel production. And so not only will it transform existing industries, it will create the possibility of new industries. It's kind of like when the internet came along and we essentially had zero-cost communications. It transformed a bunch of existing industries, but it also created a whole host of new possibilities that we couldn't possibly have foreseen beforehand. The old industry goes the other way, right? You see reversing economies of scale, you see increasing costs, you see less demand. And so in whatever industry you're thinking about, you get this kind of virtuous cycle for the new and this vicious cycle for the old, which leads very rapidly to this disruption.
And technology is disrupting other sectors too.
Instead of using cows, we're using technology, in our case, 3D printing.
Israeli startup Redefine Meat prints food from digital models, producing nearly 15 tons a day, the equivalent of 60 cows. It's one of a number of companies seeking to reduce the impact of livestock farming, which is highly polluting and uses huge amounts of land and other resources. From plant-based substitutes like this, to meat cultivated in labs, to precision fermentation which brews microorganisms to make protein. This is a brave new world poised to disrupt the global food system, and it's attracting international investment. Rosie Wardle and Kostas Yanoulis set up Synthesis Capital, a venture fund based in London, in 2021. It focuses exclusively on food tech.
I think from a global perspective, these technologies will really reduce the pressure on the earth to produce food. So if you take Redefine as an example, their products use over 90% less water and land, but also emit 90% less greenhouse gases.
These technologies can be produced locally in local areas. Let's say Redefine put a station with printers, for example, to supply West London, which remove the need for the very long supply chains across the world and provides a lot more food security for all nations.
Yeah. It might seem odd talking about feeding the world from a swanky restaurant like this, but all new products have to start somewhere before they can be scaled up and costs brought down. Redefine Meat is being showcased here. I want to try it, but I have to cook it first.
It smells amazing in here.
Are you a good chef?
You're about to find out.
We are.
Jordan Sclair is the executive chef. Okay.
So this is the lamb flank, the beef flank, and then the third dish is here. You've got this, the mincemeat version. They've done everything possibly that they can to trick the chef, I think. You can see how it's naturally meat-looking in between each one. You see that?
Yeah.
That will be amplified even more when we cook it. I actually treat it more like a fillet, where I cook it fast on the grill. Look at that, you see on that side?
Oh, yeah.
How beautiful that goes. I put it on the board here. So when I take the first slice, it actually smells like lamb. So is this the first time you've ever tried it?
It is. I'm actually really excited.
Good luck.
Good luck. Okay.
You're going to get addicted.
It looks like meat. And it really does smell like lamb. Okay. Feels like it. That's extraordinary.
For me, it's an incredible product.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I really like that.
Can we have some more?
In May 2022, Synthesis launched a dedicated food tech fund, the world's largest at $300 million. It was oversubscribed. Investors clearly reckon there's money to be made.
We think by 2050 we'll have a whole new paradigm in food, really, and that these technologies will be the vast majority of the animal protein that we consume.
Profit in the alternative protein space doesn't necessarily come at the cost of the planet, sustainability, etc. It's actually quite the opposite.
Yeah, and I'd say I think that's a broader shift in the investment world, that mainstream investors are understanding that you can't invest in a company that is having a really negative impact on the world and expect to make profits in 10 years' time. It's more thinking longer term about the planet.
Over the last few weeks, I've witnessed a growing awareness in business circles that the established economic system is no longer fit for purpose. A new system is emerging. But will the old order step aside? And will the new one surface fast enough to prevent total climate and ecological collapse? Author and educator Tony Sieber thinks market forces will enable green tech to be scaled up at speed. But still, the future hangs in the balance.
I am 100% confident that technology disruptions are going to happen, because they're going to happen for purely economic reasons. We're going to have a lot of self-sufficient communities that produce everything we need, energy, transportation, materials, food, and so on, 10 times cheaper than we can produce today without all the waste that we produce today. That is a dramatic change for society, something that we have never seen in human history. And that's coming over the next 10 to 15 years.
It sounds amazing, this vision of the future, but I keep on hearing a but, and my brain asking lots of questions. Is that because my mindset is stuck in the old system?
Well, there is a high likelihood of collapse, because every single society in the past has gone through collapse, has gone through a dark age. The difference this time is that we know what's coming, right? So if we know what's coming, then we can prepare for it. We need to develop new organizing systems, political, religious, belief systems, and so on, to take advantage of those technologies. And what you can't predict is, are we going to collapse and then rise, or are we going to rise from here? And that is the big question of our time.
So the stakes really couldn't be any higher. But how do we shift from knowledge to action? One organization in the Netherlands thinks a change in perspective may help. It uses virtual reality to give business leaders an astronaut's view of Earth, the so-called overview effect. It's the brainchild of former CEO Egbert Mulder.
It creates a new connection between you and the planet. You see the beauty of the planet, and you see the fragility of the planet. And you see from space the destruction that humankind has done to the planet, then you become very much motivated to do something about it.
The aim is to reach the hearts and minds of a million business leaders around the world by 2030. And if my experience is anything to go by, this could be a really powerful way of galvanizing the corporate world into action.
I feel quite exhausted by that experience and a whole jumble of emotions. Deep sadness, compassion, and huge gratitude for this amazing organism that we're lucky enough to be able to call home. We've been looking at systems in this series, and the systems have to change. But it's up to all of us to put as much pressure as we can on those systems so that they work for our planet, they work for our only home. Because otherwise we won't have one. It's as simple as that.
In the next program, I'm going to explore how the power of connecting to hearts as well as minds is being used by the world's faiths in a mission to rebuild our broken relationship with planet Earth.